Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for tuning in. It's good to have you here. I'm Henrik from Sweden, and you are listening to Red Eyes Radio, a beacon of sanity from Northern Europe. We highlight how our world is spiraling into chaos and turmoil, all according to plan of the global elite, and how they do this with the aid of media conditioning, a dumbed-down education system, and of course, more importantly, falsification of our history. We highlight all of these issues and so much more, and peer behind the veil to get to the real story so that you can arm yourself with accuracy and dispel the mythmakers. We go out worldwide over redicecreations.com and redicemembers.com. 3 new shows per week. Subscribe to our RSS feeds, check us out on Facebook and Twitter, and subscribe to our YouTube channel to get the latest as well. Today, Vahan Setian from Armenia is our guest. He's been examining world mythology, language, and civilizations for the last decade. He has been interviewed on numerous television programs, contributed to articles on ancient mythology, ancient Armenian history, and its language. He is an independent researcher and regularly collaborates with scholars and researchers in various fields, including anthropology and Armenology. He continues with his collaborations with Armenologists and historians around the world to further examine, decipher, and reveal most of the prehistoric elements that continue to be hidden within the Armenian highlands, the Armenian language, and their revolutionary effect on human civilization and languages. He is the author of Enigma of the Armenian Alphabet, Letters, Protons, and Paradoxes. We do have a lot to discuss today, but we'll also make sure to go into the Armenian genocide, Europe, the West, the struggle with Abrahamic religions, and much more. All right, welcome, Vahan. Nice to speak with you today. Thank you so much for coming on the program with us. It's a delight to have you here.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the honor.
It's really interesting. I think this program is going to be great. It's something I've wanted to do for a long time, discussing Armenia, the Armenian people, the history, its influence and connection to Europe and to civilization overall, but also the horrible atrocities that has happened to the Armenian people and how this is continuously downplayed and not recognized for actually what it is. I've always been, you know, fascinated with the region, the specific region of the world, around the Caucasus Mountains. I've always, you know, been puzzled as well with some of the architecture of on the churches and of course, the language connection in itself, that so many ancient pieces of literature has been in written and spoken in Aramaic, you know, the Bible, mm-hmm. for example,
sure.
all
sure.
of this stuff. So you have obviously written several books on the topic, Vahan, but so we have a lot to discuss today. But before we kind of dive into the meat of the conversation here, have you always had a close connection to your own heritage, culture, to your own people, an interest in that?
Yes, actually, I was obliged with having the exposure of the language and the people who knew about the history. So I was able to delve in there, ask questions, read more books, read books written in Europe and United States and Armenia. Some of the books that have been translated from Armenian to English for me to know more that the United States doesn't have. So I had that privilege, I would say.
Have you always been, or do you go back and forth between the U.S. and Armenia? Or
No, I haven't gone back there for at least 25 years.
So. Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah.
Is there a specific reason for that?
Well, schooling and then work and then family, you know. I'm just too immersed into the academia and work. So hopefully soon.
Yeah, exactly. I got to go back and have a feel for it. Do you know if it's transformed a lot over the years, like a lot of the other European countries has?
Well, it has. I mean, you have to consider that it went independent in the 1990s. And it has to transform itself, of course. And it had to take a lot into consideration all the changes and the governmental changes and separating from the Soviet Union and the Soviet academia, which also was a big hinder to the academia. A lot of false information was immersed into the mindset of those people. So a lot of research that was done during the Soviet Union times comes to be incorrect through current academic research and investigations.
Yeah, see, the Armenian Soviet Socialist Republic. I think a lot of people don't know about that history. That's actually fascinating. So how long were you guys plagued by this? When did this start? Was it in 22 or something? No, when was it?
Yeah. Well, you know, it has been there for at least 70 years, I mean, you might say.
Wow.
And so throughout those years, you would realize all the wars and the atrocities and the murders and so forth, like any other country, you might say. And at the same time, you know, you have to realize that the Soviet Union had to make sure that nobody went beyond the other people around the area. So when it comes to the academia, they need to downplay about ancient civilizations and so forth to make sure that they didn't go beyond the norm. In other words, if they found any ancient artifacts, they wanted to make sure that they were able to see it first before it was published. So a lot of Armenian ancient historical artifacts and ideas that were supposed to be published didn't go through. And so it had a Russian filter, basically. So most of the information that we have now from the Soviet Union, through research, of course, has been considered as incorrect. For example, the language itself, how old it is, how far back Armenians go, and the relationship to the other Indo-European languages and so forth. So now, the last 20 years, we have seen this renaissance from the scientific field, and all the different disciplines are actually giving us a different perspective. So in a sense, we are unearthing all that has been hidden under ash and debris for a very long time.
Interesting. I want to get into a little bit later of the potentiality, the why there's been a hold on some of this information and kind of why they've kept it in this way. But what do you think our listeners should know about the about Armenian history, both known and unknown as we get into it? I mean, I want to talk more about tradition, mythology, heritage, and all these things, and language itself. What should we know, do you think?
Well, it's very important for the audience, just for the sake of intellectual honesty, to realize that we're not really discovering anything new. We're just rediscovering what has been hidden for a very long time. And for example, the last 30 or 40 years, when research, in other words, when genetics, archaeogenetics has come forward, we are able to actually see how close different ethnicities are to one another. And at the same time, we're able to unearth toppled temples and artifacts. So that way, we're able to see that the Armenian history has been downplayed for a very long time. And it started actually in 1890s when the first massacres went through, the Hamidian massacres in ancient Armenia. And then it followed in 1915 with Armenian genocide. So from then on, all the way till recently, all their history has been changed, altered, misappropriated, through different reasons. And now when we see, let's say, research papers within the academia, let's say in archaeology or anthropology, a lot of people are hinged on research that was done before, let's say, the genetics came about. So all their conclusions are actually incomplete and incorrect. So now we have to completely change the entire history books that has been written the last 20 or 30 years. And it's a big mess. And a lot of researchers know about this now, and they're trying to correct all these mistakes. And at the same time, it's not that easy, because you have some friction coming from Turkey and other Azerbaijan and Georgia. They want to make sure that all this doesn't come forward, because you have to realize that 90% of the Armenian highlands, the ancestral highlands of the Armenian people, are now occupied by newer countries. So all the artifacts that are now being found or unearthed under those countries, it's not being reported, it's not being communicated as Armenian artifact. They say whether it's Georgian artifact or even Turkish or Azerbaijani, which is very anachronistic, you have to realize.
That's very interesting. I want to get into what some of the things that's being discovered here and paint a picture about, you know, for that. But for example, we have some pretty extraordinary finds today in Turkey. Obviously Göbekli Tepe and all of these sites, yes. Etc. I mean, how in proximity to cultural origins, how close are we talking about when it comes to the Armenian connection here?
Well, Göbekli Tepe is a Turkish variation of the original word, which is Portasar, which is Naval Hill. So Göbekli Tepe's actual original name is Portasar, like airport, which means naval. So that's where the word comes from. It's an Armenian term. So you have airport and so forth. So Portasar means in Naval Hill. And if you look at the ancient Armenian highlands, so if you go back to Neolithic times, actually genetics have confirmed the last 20 years that the Armenian people, as a separate ethno-linguistic group, go as far back as Neolithic, even Mesolithic times. So when we go back in time, we have to alter our way we look at history and the maps. I mean, if we go back 5 or 6,000 years, there's no more Turkey or Georgia or Azerbaijan. But, you know, genetics takes the Armenian people back all the way back there. So Göbekli Tepe, Katalhöyük, and so forth, all those cities lie within the Armenian highlands, within the borders. So if you find, for example, during the Neolithic times, the Armenian people being there, of course, you have the petroglyphs, the hieroglyphs on the Armenian caves and walls, which go back as far as 18 to even 20,000 years. And those have been deciphered. In other words, Hamlet Martirosyan in Armenia, he has deciphered those petroglyphs within the Armenian language. In other words, you can see that as influencing the Armenian alphabet, influencing everybody's alphabet, the Phoenicians, the Arameans, and so forth. So you can see the connection there. So now we're trying to rediscover all this and present it to the public, and most of the public doesn't know anything about this. So it's very easy, like for example, for Turkey to falsify information. In other words, let's say if you're a tourist and you go to Turkey and you're actually standing on ancient Armenian highlands, well, most of the tourists are not going to know that Turkey wasn't there 600 years ago.
Yeah. Right.
So Turkey is going to say, well, this is a Turkish artifact, or let's say Hittite artifact, for instance, even though it can be Armenian artifact. Another example is the British Museum. They have all these artifacts, which was found in ancient Armenia, and they say it is ancient Turkish artifact. Now, you realize how absurd that is. It's like saying ancient United States. I don't think you're able to say that. I mean, if we find something 1,000 years ago, which relates to the Navajo, for instance, we're not going to say we found this in ancient United States. We're going to say we found this in North America that relates to the Navajo, for instance. Yeah, that's not happening in those areas because most of the people are ignorant about geography and history and so forth.
Well, exactly. Very good point. And I mean, obviously, then we have a lot of other issues of, I mean, let's not even get into all the migrations that have occurred and happened, right,
yeah,
throughout the years.
Yeah.
Even in the, you know, 500 or 400 to 600s, you know, if we look at the BC scale here, then
yeah,
tremendous amounts of movements. But even before that, we know that there's been, I mean, again, North America, we'd had Clovis people, Soltrian, you know, there's like, people have been moving all over the place. So
sure,
how do we pin down what's what in that regard?
Well, you have to look at all the disciplines that we have. I mean, we do have archaeology, anthropology, genetics, and archaeogenetics. And we also have to look at the Indo-European language tree overall. As you know, it was called the Aryan language group as opposed to Indo-European.
Yeah,
and it was
right,
because of Hitler that was changed. And so because of that, we have misunderstood what that language tree tells us. If we just change to its original name to Aryan, and now we have to look at where the Aryan etymology comes forward. I mean, if you look at the dictionaries throughout the world, they won't be able to tell you what that actually word means, because they don't know the Armenian language. Aryan means Ar, which is the sun god of the Armenian people, and Yan means offspring. So you have offspring of Ar, another good offspring of god Ar. And that Ar, A-R, you can find Armenia, for example, and Ar has evolved. In other words, it has evolved to O-R, U-R, A-R, and Hur, Her, Germany. In other words, you have Orient, you have Ari, Stokrat, you have Hermann, German, Germany. In other words, all those two words have actually, those two terms, two letters, have changed and altered throughout history. So when you go back in time, you're able to decipher what language other languages affiliate with. You're able to look at genetics to see how far back these people go. So for example, if I go back to Neolithic times, 7,000 years ago, and I find a settlement which was unearthed, we can very likely say that if it falls within the same geographic area and those people have been living there for thousands of years, we can certainly say that's an Armenian artifact. For example, we can certainly say that the Sumerians coexisted with the Armenian people because in the Epic of Gilgamesh, it says that their ancestors came from Arata, which is Ararat, the Armenian highlands. You can see that. Not only that, you can see Armenian words in the Sumerian words too. Armenian words have the closest affinity to the Sumerian language. I mean, for example, for skeleton, they say kamakh, Armenians say kamakh. You have hundreds of words like that within the Sumerian language. So now you can see that those two people coexisted with one another. That's even before the Akkadians came, before Babylonia and so forth. So you have to look at the time scale and compare that to the other civilizations that came about.
Yeah, I mean, for a long time, scientists have been trying to tie it back to a kind of a root language, if you will, and really see basically a standard language at some point, and then different variations of it began to occur. How close is Armenian today to that? Has Armenian gone through transformations as basically all languages have done as well, or is it close still?
Let's look at it this way. If you go back to 1800s, before the Armenian genocides happened, you see that the European linguists, just by language alone, they were able to determine how important the Armenian language is in connection with the other languages. In other words, it gave rise to many of the Indo-European languages. And all of a sudden, that changed after the genocide. All those things changed, and now Armenian is considered to be, let's say, was influenced by others, let's say Persian or Sanskrit. But they're reversing the truth. I mean, in Hilbrecht, Heinrich Hilbrecht in 1800s, he said that the Armenian language basically provides foundation for the Hittite language. And if you look at Atkinson and Gray's graph, which was published in Nature magazine 2003, they indicate that the Armenian language is the oldest ethno-language Aryan language that has survived since the Ice Age. I mean, if Hilbrecht is saying that the Armenian language is the foundation for Hittite, and Atkinson and Gray are saying that the Armenian language is basically the oldest which has survived. Now you can put that into an actual perspective, how old the Armenian language is and how it has influenced other. I mean, you can find the Armenian language everywhere around the world. You can find the Armenian language in the Polynesia, in Indonesia, in Basque, in northern Spain. You can find Armenian words in the old Egyptian hieroglyphs, in the Sumerian language. It has the highest frequency ever. It's amazing. It's not even a coincidence anymore. I mean, we have hundreds of Armenian words in Basque. We have thousands of words in Polynesia, which was deciphered by Leila Stepani in Armenia. In Polynesia, in Indonesia. Let me give you an example. The volcano mountain, Krakatau. I'm sure you've heard that before.
Sure.
Many historians and linguists are trying to determine the etymology of that term. They can't figure out. So what they write is it's unknown, in quotes. So people accept that and say, okay, that's fine, it's unknown. But if you know Armenian language, it says something that gives fire, Krakatau. So just by Armenian language alone, you can actually decipher a lot of linguistic enigmas that can't be deciphered yet. So that's why I think, for example, the works like Graham Hancock, for instance, and Miss Murdoch, who was on your show, and Hugh Fox, they're going toward this idea, but they don't have the relevant information for them to have complete conclusions regarding this. And in due time, they will.
Very interesting. Now, I want to just tie back here a little bit because you mentioned a very important aspect as well in terms of the, Indo-European origins or whatnot, or, you know, gasp, the Aryan connection, right? Because what occurred in the 1910 maybe and onward, but culminating around 1930, 1945, many people have been turned off to any kind of research related to this topic, which I believe has been a very clever tactic in terms of, you know, how it's been used to destroy any kind of legitimacy surrounding the concepts of, you know, Indo-Aryan, whether one believes in it or not. And again, just because, you know, people have interpreted what they believe that the findings of a group like the Annenerbe, for example, in Germany, under the National Socialists, what they did, etc. They did research, archaeological and cultural history and whatnot. People basically throw that out because they think it's taboo. Discredited, right? It's taboo, it's discredited. The same could be said with the connection to the Theosophical Society, for example, because there are similarities. So this is a common fallacy with guilt by association, etc. And just because you mention it, you're a Nazi. Well, how do you view this discussion?
Well, I think it's very important. I mean, we're not really promoting any racism or nationalism. Nothing at all. I mean, we're just dealing with history. I mean, look at the swastika. Swastika, the oldest swastika that has been found, is in the Armenian highlands that goes back as far as 15,000 years. A lot of people don't know that.
Yeah.
And I talk about this in my new book, which will come out soon. And you can see how it actually has given rise to, let's say, the concept of love and the concept of infinity and eternal bliss, for instance, and sun worship and so forth. Rick Merrick, who wrote the Venus Blueprint, I'm not sure if you have read it or people have read it, he says that all religions are descended from the ancient Vedic cosmology, as described in the Rig Veda, originating in Armenia near Mount Ararat at least 1600 years ago. He's being very conservative. And he's saying that the basic concepts of sacred transcendental mountain extend, in other words, the mountain itself, Mount Ararat itself, that extends into space. In other words, he's saying that astrotheology migrated from the Armenian highlanders all the way to Sumer, Ethiopia, Egypt, India, and so forth. So if we even read the Rig Veda, and try to decipher the swastika and so forth, you know, even in Rig Veda it says that the Aryans migrated into the Indus Valley. So you have to say, okay, these people came from elsewhere. Where did they come from? Okay, so let's follow the path of the swastika. If we follow the path of the swastika, it transcends beyond Ukraine. It actually goes back to Armenian highlands. And you can see it on the wall still. They're still on the walls. So if we are trying to understand the delusion of Hitler, for instance, and his misguidance when it comes to the concept of Aryanism and so forth, you know, we have to look at it from the ethno-linguistic group. From a language standpoint, what does it mean as a language, as people, as ideals, as opposed to a race where it should exterminate all the others? So that's the problem. People automatically consider this has to do with nationalism and racism and so forth, which is not. It's absolutely untrue. So I think people need to be a little bit open-minded, because by unearthing this alone can give us a very good perspective of all the other ancient people and how they looked at astrotheology. How did astrotheology actually influence the Bible and the Egyptian astrotheology and so forth? This is all interconnected. You know, it's not in a vacuum. I mean, if you look at the astrotheology of the Polynesians, you can see that it came from elsewhere. If you go back to North America, you can see their astrotheology came from elsewhere. So you have to find where is that interconnectedness lie? Where do we have to go back to civilization? And of course, Mr. Lang in the 1980s, he said the cradle of civilization is in the Armenian highlands. Now, what does that mean? It doesn't mean the origins of humans. It says that the transition from hunter and gatherers into a civilization took place in the Armenian highlands. You see, all the roads lead to Rome, but all the arrows of human civilization lead to Armenian highlands, because we find the first agriculture there, systematic. We find first animal domestication. We find the first metal smelting, astronomy, astrotheology. Ivanov Gamgrelidze in the 1980s, they confirmed that the Indo-European language tree roots out of the Armenian highlands. You know, we find the oldest temple there, Gobekli Tepe. We find the oldest winery, the oldest shoe, the oldest preserved brain, the oldest skirt. We're not really dealing with, let's say, a hunter and gatherer has just ate his prey and he doesn't know what to do, so he makes a flute out of a fibula of the animal. We're talking about a revolution of how people thought. Preservation of food, for instance, the first writing. In other words, preservation of all the things they could do to make sure that they build societies and structure theology and religion and so forth.
Indeed, very interesting. Now, how do you explain some of the origin points? I know that that's a kind of a broader discussion and a mystery in itself, of course, but how do you think that it was by happen chance that they were in this region, that people decided to settle here? I would assume to a certain extent that all people who were hunter and gatherers, they were nomadic, they were moving around, etc.
Sure.
But at some point,
sure,
there's a decision here that, all right, let's try to do some kind of more permanent settlements. Although it might not be that clear, though, as we've seen again from Göbekli Tepe, for example, it might have been a religious site first that was, and it wasn't necessarily that, they farmed everything here. There might have been hunter-gatherers still, but they had a religious temple facility in this area, right? So what do you think?
Well, if you examine Göbekli Tepe, Port Asar, if you look at the way it's done and it's carved, I don't think just desert nomads or nomads at all would actually do such a sophisticated thing. I mean, we are talking about a 3D carving on the actual temple. I mean, we're talking about a lion and all the other animals. I mean, it's all 3D. Even the current artists can even do that. So we can't really assume that they basically were just nomads, hunter and gatherers. They decided to do that. You have to go back thousands of years before that. You can see that they were able to understand stars and cosmology, of course, the crude way, but they were able to look at the stars and decipher the movement of the sun and the stars and the constellations and so forth. Even Alcott, the British astronomer in 1800s, he said the time was divided in the Armenian Highlands near Mount Ararat. So you have to look at Göbekli Tepe and look at how it's structured. And you have to say to yourself, at least logically, that these people have been around much more than that for them to be able to make a structure like that. Even if it's a astrotheological center, I mean, you have to allow those people to evolve and understand the cosmos for them to eventually do something like that. And it's not very far-fetched idea that if you go back to the Sphinx, for instance, in Egypt, I mean, it's absurd to say that the Sphinx was built by the Egyptians 4,000 years ago. I mean, if you really are looking at the Sphinx, I mean, you can see that the Sphinx head was a lion. And if you stand in the back of it and just turn back time, let's say 12,000 years, you see that the sun, the Leo constellation, rises where the Sphinx looks at.
Right.
And the Sphinx, being at that age, is the same age as Göbekli Tepe. So you can certainly say that, you know, let's say the same people who built the Göbekli Tepe might have just built the Sphinx themselves. Because let me give you one fact. If you look at the oldest petroglyphs in Egypt, let's say the pictures of ships and boats, they are the exact copy from the Armenian Highlands, exact copy, but the Armenian Highlands petroglyphs predate the Egyptian oldest petroglyphs by 7,000 years.
I was astonished when I've been looking at some of these the rock carvings and petroglyphs as well, and there's a more distinct similarity in a certain area again what today is Azerbaijan. You know, we have even had this famous Norwegian explorer Tor Heyerdahl, who actually were working on this particular theory, and he saw out in the desert in Gobustan there is some extraordinary rock carvings, and they are basically identical to the ones you find up in Scandinavia, Northern Europe, all over Sweden and Norway, Denmark. You know, it's like, and he was on the trail that even from our mythological record, again, I don't want to get too much sidetracked here, but I want to talk a little bit about comparative mythology and basically taking different art forms from different parts of the world to demonstrate how similar they are, you know. But he talked about the from Norse mythology, we have a people called the Asir, which he derived from being related to Aser, you know, Bajan, Azerbaijan. So this is the same people. It might not be the same people that's there today, I guess, but the point there is being that They're so extraordinarily similar in terms of even the big calves you can see on the men standing and the way they hold things and everything. It's like, it's remarkable. I mean, it has to be a connection here. This is not by chance, you know?
Of course. And nothing is in vacuum. In other words, all these civilizations have interdependence, interconnectedness, and an origination point. You know, these have to be considered. And we also have to consider the fact that, when we resort to peer-reviewed articles, for example, and we want to write a research paper, we wouldn't know whether they're right or wrong when it comes to certain ideas. For example, if we're going to rely on the fact, let's say, that the Sphinx is 4,000 years old only, all the other research that, let's say, Graham Hancock does, those academicians are going to say, well, he's wrong. Well, not necessarily. I mean, he is taking other elements into consideration, and he's really shaking the academia, the Egyptological academia. And, for example, his perspectives rely much more on intellectual honesty and all the other elements that has been shunned away with when it comes to the other Egyptologists. So we need to consider all this. So the further we go back in time, the more we stretch the timeline, it will be much easier for us to really understand this interconnectedness between the area that you talked about with Scandinavia and so forth. You know, we have to stretch the time. Human civilization is much older than that, and we're not giving credit to them.
Exactly, definitely. And again, I'm looking right now at some of the rock carvings out of Armenia, and it's like, yep, that could be on a rock right there in Tanum in Bohuslän up in Sweden. You know, it's amazing.
Yep.
Yep. The ships and everything and the animals, and it's fantastic, amazing.
Yeah, and if you look at the Armenian petroglyphs, it's not only just pictures of animals. They're very distinct shapes, and you can see how it was evolved into the letters themselves. It's understandable, let's say, if the hunter and gatherer just draws pictures of animals, but you also have certain symbols. That's the thing. Why would a hunter and gatherer start carving symbols?
The sun wheel, the kind of a formulation of the swastika that you said before. This showed up I think it was in Ukraine, in the, I think it's called the Arata civilization. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correct. But
Arata is Ararat. Arata has the root word. Arat means abundant. Ara, which is just the sun god. So Arata means a place of Ar, the creation of Ar, where the creation took place. Of course, it's mythology, but you have to consider the astrotheological meaning for that. That's why in Epic of Gilgamesh, they say that they came from land of Arata.
Yeah.
Ararat,
Fascinating. So where do you stand in terms of influences and everything else? How far deep down that rabbit hole do you go? I mean, I'm it's always fascinating to look at, you know, aliens and all that stuff, but I think we don't necessarily have to go there either. I mean, humans are, their ingenuity, they're creative, they do some remarkable things, and I think we, to a certain extent, put ourselves down too much if we just consider everything to be somewhere else and look, you know, for everyone else all the time, and someone else has to be the origin point of it. I mean, I think that there's a lot of fascinating things to look at on the very straight up level of human development and origin in itself. That's a mystery in itself. Where do you stand on those questions?
Well, I mean, we can put aside the alien part for just a second. I mean, we can certainly entertain it. I mean, I can certainly say that we're not alone, considering how many stars we have and how many galaxies. That's not the issue. But I mean, if we look at the from a natural standpoint, how humanity has progressed and evolved and so forth, it's amazing how the Neolithic revolution revolutionized the way we think. I mean, something happened up there. I mean, there needed to be some spike. I mean, it can be a mental enlightenment. I mean, we can talk about a sunburst. We can talk about the UV rays, something that's helped humanity to be much smarter. You know, we can go into those hypotheses and so forth. You know, we can talk about whether there was a cosmic event that allowed human beings to be much smarter. But, you know, if we just look at how everything evolved, I mean, I compared all the different developments throughout the ancient world. And again, I mean, if we go back to the Armenian highlands, we see that the biggest developments took place there. I mean, if they were able to domesticate, let's say, the goat and the sheep there, which means that they were able to construct and weave, and they were able to weave carpets and so forth. So basically the wool came from there too. So you have to consider what was going through their minds for them to look at their environment. I mean, there must have been settlers there. You need those people to coexist and stay in those lands for a very long time for them to discover all these things. You can't be a desert nomad walking around and going to find food for you to be able to build architecture and metallurgy, for instance. I mean, those people really understood about metals. When the Armenian Highlanders were using iron in Babylon and Assyria, they didn't know what iron was. So you kind of wonder, you know, what do they know about chemistry that we don't? I mean, we were able to find this artifact recently that was found in Armenia, and it's sort of like a bird artifact, and it has been taken to the German labs, and they don't know what the metal consistency is. It doesn't rust, so they don't know what metal it is.
Hmm. Interesting. New kind of compound. Yeah, there are fascinating finds like that, obviously, out of place. And we realize when we look at it, like how far back civilization go. But where would you, I mean, Armenia is basically almost as close to Iraq as it is to Russia. It's right in between there. It's in other words, almost close to the Middle East or the East. It's far down south compared to the rest of Europe. Mm-hmm. Do you consider Armenia to be part of, is it European or how would you define it? Is it something else, something different?
Well, I don't know how to define it. I mean, we're dealing with certain artificial geographical names and locations at the moment. I mean, we have borders to consider. But I would consider Armenia to be, let's say, the... I didn't want to use Anatolia because Anatolia is incorrect. It's a made up word just to distort information. Just FYI, just for your information, Anatolia is basically trying to replace the word Armenian Highlands, which was used in the 1800s. It's basically just to replace those people, you know, from those lands and hide it. You know, sometimes they will use Eastern Anatolia. Anatolia means east. So if you say Eastern Anatolia, that means east. It's very illogical. But they use it because most of the people are ignorant about geography and words and so forth. So for me, Armenia, I would say it's Eastern European, you know, from that standpoint. But, you know, when it comes to naming it, you know, I always call it the Armenian Highlands just because those people have been there for such a very long time.
Yeah, indeed, definitely. Now, would you consider that it's the origin point of the European people as well?
Yes, absolutely. If you look at the origin of the European people, you have to look at it as an ethno-linguistic people and group themselves. I mean, if we have all these evidences that the Indo-European language or the Aryan language tree came about in the Armenian Highlands, then you might say, okay, those people just out-migrated, went to different parts of the world, and they settled, and of course their language changed and evolved throughout thousands of years, and they inherited their own culture, and they made it their own ways of doing things. I mean, if we just look at different sources, for instance, the Anglo-Saxon Chronicles, for instance, right, that was written in the 1860s, in the first paragraph, it says that the Brits basically came to Britain from Armenia. Hmm. It was written by King Alfred in 1860s. It says that. Now, let's say people say, okay, well, maybe that's not true because they're relying on biblical mythology. I understand that. But if you look at the genetic makeup of the Brits and we compare it to the Armenians near Karabakh and Sunik, they have the closest affinity. So now we have a genetic connection too. So we can't just dismiss by saying that it's biblical mythology. I mean, we have genetic, you know, connections with one another. Same thing with Basque, for instance.
Right.
I mean, if you look at the Basque, their folk tales talk about, you know, their people coming from the Armenian Highlands. And the thing is, their language says the same thing. We have... for example, for a cave, they say Karanza. Armenians say Karanzav. It's the same thing. I mean, we have hundreds and hundreds of words that actually are the same. Not just sound the same, but mean the same thing and the same grammar. So we have to find all these connectedness, you know, through language. I think language is more important. It actually can provide us more information than DNA alone.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah. But for a long time as well, we heard about a Phoenician, kind of a Canaanite connection. Is that anything as well?
First of all, the Phoenician, the idea of the Phoenicians is not truly defined. They always call it the Semitic people, but that's not true because the term Semitic is actually an invention which was done in the 1800s, basically just to separate, you know, let's say, white people between Semitic and so forth. That's incorrect. You have to go back further back in time. I mean, where Palestine is, for instance, and Lebanon, before, let's say, the Semitic people went there, they were Indo-Europeans there. So very naturally, the Indo-European language was immersed into the Semitic languages. Same thing with Aramean, for example. Aramean is Aram, which has to be the Armenian terminology. But eventually it was transferred into Semitic because the Semites spoke Aramaic. They were able to use, let's say, the Phoenician script to write Aramaic script, and then Aramaic script to be used to write Hebrew and so forth. So there is a connection there, but you have to go to the root. You know, where does it start? I mean, you can see that the Sumerians offer the first writing, for instance, to the Phoenicians, and then the Phoenicians use that script and then to develop all the others.
Exactly. It's a fascinating study. I think language, as you say, is a huge key in this. Well, let's keep the concept of language and origins and culture and tradition in the back of our head as we move onward here a little bit and talk mm-hmm. a little bit more about. I wanted to talk about the onset of Christianity and the pre-Christian traditions and culture in Armenia and the Armenian people there.
Yes.
We know about the expansion of Christianity. Again, we've talked about that many times in the program. I think from the point of view of Northern Europe, we're probably we have to our advantage that it came up there so late. So, for example, mm-hmm. out of Iceland, which is one of the last Christianized nations we have back in 1100s, 1200s, even in some cases, traditions left. But when did mm-hmm. this begin in Armenia?
Well, of course, Christianity took. If you want to decipher this problem, I call it a problem just because there's so much that the public doesn't know. You have to look at Christianity as this gradual progression and then absorption of many other mythologies that eventually it took its own shape. There were, of course, Christian sects all over. I mean, the very small groups, throughout the Middle East and the Near East. And then eventually it grew. So, of course, you can find, let's say, some Christian groups in the second century in Armenia, preaching and so forth. But the real blow came in around 301. And when I say blow, I mean that wave completely destroyed the Armenian culture. I compared the destruction of Christianity to other locations and other cultures and countries.
Mm-hmm.
You can see that there are still some artifacts left from Greece, for instance, in Rome, in Ukraine and Croatia, for instance. But in Armenia, it was absolute. I mean, nothing is left from their pre-Christian times. There's only one temple left, which is Garni, and it has been restored several times. Nothing from pre-Christian Armenian literature is left, even though we have many attestations that there was literature, and that's gone. All the gold was melted. Everything was incorporated into Christianity. All the Mithraic priests were killed. Their literature was taken. So from that standpoint, I see it's a disaster that now we're trying to unearth all this. And so there is a lot of resistance, of course, and you have the Christian population that didn't want to know about what travesties took place. But
sure, yeah.
if we're able to reconstruct and save the Armenian heritage, we have to go there. We have to look at what lies underneath those churches. I mean, you already know, even in Europe and in let's say in Italy and in Rome, all the churches have been built on top of Mithraic temples.
Yeah.
Even Vatican is on top of a Mithraic temple. So what lies underneath the ground is much more than what we have unearthed so far. So we have to look at that.
Well, exactly. It's just amazing when we think back of it and how, in some cases, what a quick invader this was and how it, but again, people don't realize that the violence that came with the new ideology here as well. What do you know about, as you said, a lot of priests were killed and everything else. I mean, we have stories from Northern Europe where basically people are beheaded in front of their families,
of course,
who refuse to convert,
Exactly. That's the same thing I'm trying to relate to the Armenian population and to the world. I mean, it's not a unique situation to Armenia. All the other places in the world, have seen atrocities that took place. Of course, whenever a new religion comes through, you have all these atrocities. But when it comes to Abrahamic monotheism, it was pretty intolerant faith, different faiths. So they were able to destroy everything. I mean, when you had Mithraism, they were tolerant of other faiths. But when it comes to Christianity and all the others, they were not. So everybody had to be killed. And the interesting thing about the Armenian Christianity was between 301 all the way to 404, which was the time that people say that the Armenian alphabet was created. That's 100 years. That's four generations. So you're talking about a four generation of erasing of people's memory from their ancestral past. Mm-hmm. So now let's say when a child is born in 404 AD, they're not going to know that what has transpired 100 years ago. Who are my ancestors, for instance? So whatever they heard about their ancestors came from, of course, the current priests and whatever they learned in school. They would not go and say, okay, where are temples? Where is my ancestral literature and ancestral theology? What about the poems? I mean, there were temples, thousands of temples in Armenia. And Ms. Murdoch actually is very honest with that. You know, she was saying that the last stronghold of Mithraism was in Armenia. So if you're going to build all these temples and you don't have any literature, for instance, before it was invented, in quotes, where are the blueprints? I mean, you have to share all this information to your next generation, right?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. So that's exactly it. We are completely void of logic in this. I mean, logic is really missing in a lot of all these discussions, and we need to make sure that people know that there's something called logic, there's something called intellectual honesty. You know, let's go back and find out what has been destroyed. Because if we go back there and see how much it has been destroyed, we will realize we have nothing left.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, we're talking about thousands of years of development, a way of life where we learn to live with the nature that we found ourselves in as mankind was awakening, I guess, to a certain extent, to a new, sure, you know, realization of what is happening. I mean, all of these traditions, there is science, there is a way of life, there's a connection with nature and everything else. Mm-hmm. And this, you know, Johnny Come Lately Christianity version here is completely ruthless, and it managed to topple over. What was there, do you think that people willfully also kind of converted to it, or was it more they realized the threat of it and said, all right, okay, or has it been, for example, in other parts of the world, you still had a lot of lingering on of other traditions and so-called pagans or heathens, mm-hmm, or what have you, but was there a similar scenario, do you think, in Armenia, where people still clang on to or were holding on to their old traditions?
Well, yes. All those people who didn't want to abide by the new Christian faith, they were expelled. And, you know, let's say, for example, in 1900s, there was a group that was expelled who was against, let's say, the Armenian church, and they went to Bavaria and they formed the first settlement in Bavaria. And that's where the word Bavar comes from. Bavaria is, it was one of the prince's name of the Armenian group that came, they went from Armenia to Bavaria. But, you know, if you have all those people, I mean, look at it this way. If your ancestors have been worshiping their ancestral gods for thousands of years, you know, there has to be some bloodshed for you to change your faith, you know, instantaneously. Yeah. You know, right. You know, there had to be some enormous genocide happening. I mean, you can see also in different medieval authors that talk about all the atrocities that took place. All those people that didn't want to convert, they were killed and they were misplaced and expelled. You know, you see that. But it was actually much more sinister than that in Armenia because, you know, nothing has been left, as mentioned. And now we're trying to go through, you know, Greco-Roman authors for us to, you know, save the, you know, Armenian ancestral history. And that's very unfortunate because, I mean, for example, when you look at the Greeks, you know, they still have something saved from pre-Christian times, so they're able to resort to that. But Armenians can't. You know, there's nothing has been left. I'm sure that there are certain pre-Christian literature that is out there but has been hidden because once it's found, it's going to completely change the way we look at Armenian literature and their alphabet and so forth. So that's why we need to find, you know, the missing elements. Where are the pre-Christian Armenian literature? Where are they? I mean, the Greco-Roman authors talk about them.
Right.
They weren't invented. I mean, if let's say Messer of Mashtots, which is considered to be the person who invented, in quotes, the Armenian alphabet, if he invented, then are you telling me that these people who have had a god that was considered to be the god of literature before Christianity, for instance, they were worshipping a god of literature without having their own literature? I mean, why would you do that?
Right, yeah. Well, it's a fascinating. Do you think that there will be finds like that perhaps in the future.
Sure, yeah. I'm sure. I mean, thanks to you and all the other academicians and the opportunities that we're able to communicate, you know, you can see a lot of excavations going on. I mean, just for example, the Armenian letters alone, and now we can see that the Armenian letters have been carved on the walls for thousands of years before Mesir Mashtots, you know, introduced it to the world. You can see that now. And that's because of academia, it's because of research. You know, we're able to unearth new temples now in Ani. And also there are a lot of temples in occupied Turkey right now. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if they find, let's say, an Armenian temple, you know, they're not going to say to the world, you know, we found something. They're either going to destroy it, as they do now the churches, or they're going to hide it and make that their own. So we have a big problem where all these things lie underneath the ground in all these different countries, which was part of the part of Armenia. Now we can't even have access to it. Nobody's going to allow us, let's say, to go to Turkey and do excavations, even though it's let's say, it could be an Armenian artifact. We can't get a hold of it. So right. How are we able to decipher all this and let people know, even the world know, about, let's say, the Armenian people and their connectedness to the other ancient people, if we can't have access to 90% of the occupied land?
Well, see, this is something we can ask you a little bit more about this now before we wrap things up with the first segment here, but this is something I want to talk more about in the second hour as well, the onset of, obviously, of monotheism, the Abrahamic virus, as I call it, and we have another, we have different factions of this, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, of course, and Islam, the Turkish Empire, the Ottoman Empire. This is specifically what I'm talk more about in the second with the genocide and everything and where some of the responsibility and all that lies. But how, just maybe briefly here before we wrap things up, maybe you can just tell us a little bit about the relationship to Islam and Armenia. What has happened there? How are relations?
Are you talking about in the early 1900s? Where the genocide happened?
Let's talk a little bit more about right now. How are they today? And then we can get into the history.
Well, I would say the situation is very severe. I mean, you know, you have, let's say, an Islamic country of Turkey, of Islamic country of Azerbaijan over there. So you they're basically in between these two powers there, and they have very little movement of what to do. They're basically misplaced. And so they're trying to rely on their own people and the intellects of their own people to make sure that they coexist. It's a severe situation right now. Azerbaijan is trying to get a hold of more of the Armenian lands, and Turkey is trying to deny still the Armenian genocide that took place. And so right now we're trying to really show the world that this is what's happening, and these atrocities that are still taking place. There are still people dying, you know, on the borders, you know, because of this friction. So we want to make sure that everybody knows about this and they're vocal about it.
Well, exactly. I mean, is there any kind of threat of conversion or else? I mean, I think you posted something on your Facebook page there about, I mean, okay, it's just one example, but it tells of what some of the climate might be at this stage. It was a Kurdish dude there who issued a threat against Christian Armenians in Lebanon, I believe, that they have to convert, right?
Oh yeah, I mean the conversion is not going to take place. I mean, especially into Islam, but there is threat everywhere when it comes to conversions and you know, using all those archaic books to change all that within the geography and people's mindsets. And I think that Armenian people are strong enough for them to persevere throughout all this. And it needs the international community for help. That's for sure.
All right, much more to discuss here in the second hour. We're going to pick up after the break. But before we take a break, let's give out all the details here, Vahan, about where people can reach you, how they can buy the book. Please give us the titles of the books as well. We need to give that out. And if people want to dive into more of this, where should they go?
Sure. Well, my first book was published. It was a booklet, I would say, just because I needed to just publish the first chapter of that. It's called The Enigma of the Armenian Alphabet. And it can be reached through Amazon.com and Lulu.com, L-U-L-U.com. And the second book will be released around July the 4th of this year. And it's called The Language as a Fingerprint. And it can be attained at the moment. It's on pre-order through thearmenian.com. And the publisher is going to release that pretty soon, all the details. So you can follow I have a Facebook history page called Historicity of the Armenian People. from Neolithic times to the present, and you can follow me through that, and you can send me messages and I can answer them for you. Thank you.
Very good. We're going to have the links to the books as well here up, Language as Fingerprint, the new one coming out. And even, guys, look at the book cover there and look at the similarities to some of the rock carvings in Scandinavia. It's just amazing. But we'll talk more about that later. But all right. Do you want to give out your Facebook page as well, perhaps?
Yes, the Facebook page is called Historicity of the Armenian People, from Neolithic times to the present.
All right, very good. We'll end on that note. We'll pick things up after the break. Stay with us. We'll be right back with more.